Okay, some really fun Mishnah today. We might finish this chapter 5, or we might not. So we're going to do a whole bunch of midrashim, of like close readings of the verses that have nothing to do with the Sota, except for the first one, which we did last week. We had this turning around. Oh yeah, also I remember that some of you have asked me for recordings, and I haven't got them to you, but I it's on my list to send them to you, and I will after this. Okay, yeah, so we looked at this last time about the repetition of of the waters came, or the waters will come, and the repetition of being impure, being defiled, that whole rhetoric throughout the chapter. Rabbi Akiva uses that to anchor this idea that not only is the wife punished from the Sota ritual, but also the adulterer is punished in the same way at the same moment. And then we had Rabbi Yoshua, who came along and said, that's also how Zechariah ben HaKatzav used to say, and that's high praise to say that, Rabbi Akiva, you intuited something which one of my teachers would have said. That's very high praise for the Mishnah. And then Rabbi comes along with this perhaps compromise position, trying to make this drash come from a slightly different format, or maybe he's just restating what Rabbi Akiva said. We sort of left that a little open. So now we're going to continue with a couple more midrashim by Rabbi Akiva, and then one by someone else at the end. And it's going to start off, the next midrashim, we're all going to start off with this Bo Bayom formula. If you've been learning Daf Yomi and you're in Brachot, you'll know that Bo Bayom, Daf Yomi is now well into Shabbat, but when it was in Brachot, Bo Bayom is understood by the Talmud to mean the specific day. That day, which day? It was the specific day when Rabban Gamliel was deposed from the being the Nasi, from being the patriarch, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was put in to replace him. Rabban Gamliel was his contribution was to sort of make Torah learning more elitist and to keep out people he didn't think belonged to the Beit Midrash. The Bo Bayom, that day, was when he was deposed and all these people flooded the Beit Midrash, and the whole of learning sort of opened up by inviting all these new people in to learn. That's how the Talmud sort of mythologizes this Bo Bayom. There's no indication of that in the Mishnah at all. There's no indication that Rabban Gamliel was deposed. There's no indication that any of those, any of that story is Tanaitic. It seems to be totally Talmudic. And the pshat for this, the Bo Bayom, is just the same day that Rabbi Akiva did this first drash. Seems pretty clear. So yeah, there was one day Rabbi Akiva was just on fire. He had just amazing drashot. The first one was about the Sota, and later on that day, or on the same day, he came up with this other amazing way to read the Psukim. And you're going to see that Rabbi Yoshua again is going to show up and praise Rabbi Akiva's reading, close reading, Rabbi Yoshua being one of Rabbi Akiva's primary teachers. Okay, Bo Bayom. Darash Rabbi Akiva. On that day, Rabbi Akiva made this explanation. B'chol kli cheres asher yipol mehem el tocho kol asher b'tocho yitma. Any earthenware vessel that any of them fall into, inside it, anything that is in it will be impure. So the topic of the verse is insects, shratzim, which are... They're called, this is, now we're going to get into Tuma language, they're called the Avhatuma. They're one of the primary sources of impurity, insects. And if an insect falls into a clay vessel, everything, all the food that was inside the vessel, according to the Torah, becomes impure. It can't be used in any temple service. If it was sanctified for temple use, it becomes totally unsanctified. So this is about the purity of the food in the clay vessel. Now let me explain the way that the way that the Mishnah understands how tuma works. There's the av hatuma, the primary source of impurity. That's things like a sheret, an insect, or a menstruating woman, or a corpse. Those are kind of like the core fathers of impurity. How is insect defined? It's a good question, and I'm sure the Mishnah answers that in some way. It really is. Any insect could make the food impure. That doesn't mean, by the way, not kosher, right? You could still eat impure food as long as you're not a priest or you're in various other situations, but that's a different, the question of insects falling into food and if it makes it unkosher, that's a separate question than the question of whether it makes it impure or not. So anyway, so there's the alfatuma, there's the primary source of impurity. Anything, if the primary source of impurity touches something else, touches like a person, for example, that person or a clothes or a vessel, earthenware or some kind of other finished item, some other tool or vessel, that becomes a rishon letumah, that becomes a first level of uncleanness, of impurity. A rishon letumah can now render other things it touches. So if I touch a corpse, I'm now a rishon letumah. I touched an av hatumah, so now I'm a first degree impurity. If I then touch some food, the food becomes second degree impurity. If that food then goes on to touch other food, food which is truma, which is supposed to be given to the priests, that truma becomes shlishi letumah. It becomes a third degree level impurity. And if then that truma, that impure truma, touches a sacrifices, the sacrifices become a fourth level. They become revi'i letumah. So that's how the system works. And the fourth level can't do anything else. It can't continue its tumor path. It doesn't render anything else impure. So there's sort of this hierarchy. It starts off with the av hatumah. The av hatumah can make vessels or people impure, and then people or vessels can only make food impure, and then food can only make more stringent food impure. And that's the system that is set up. This is a way, you'll see a bunch of ways to understand this Mishnah. I'm sure the Gemara understands this differently, but I think that what you're going to see is Rabbi Akiva sort of defining how the system even comes from the verses at all. And actually, it's very, very clever. What if a fly lands on it? Yes, I think that's... let's look up the verse just to be sure. Any of the one which falls when dead shall be unclean. Any of those falls, they're still talking about the dead sherets. So a fly landing on it is not a problem. It's a dead fly falling into it. The way he understands this yitma. So now this yitma is in the nifal construction. It's in passive. Became impure. But the same letters can be read as yitama, which is it makes other things impure. So what he's going to do is he's going to read this yitma, because it could have just said tame, which is just a descriptive. It is impure. Instead, it uses this extra yod to say yitma, which is to say that it became unclean. It becomes unclean, which could be vocalized instead as yitame. It makes other things unclean, okay? And this is actually a brilliant thing, which I saw in Mira Balberg's book on Tuma. If you ever want to get like a sense of the Mishnaic system of, if you ever, you know, just sat around and be like, oh, I wish I had a good sense of the Mishnaic system of Tuma and Tahara, the answer is you should read Mira Balberg's book. But she points out that, which is pretty common, that Chazal, the rabbis in the Mishnah, understand the PL as a doubled form. So PL verbs like yitame are understood as doubling. In other words, not only is it impure, it can also make other things impure. The perfect example of this doubling is the word mudaber. Mudaber implies speaking in a conversation, right? You speak, they speak, you both speak. As opposed to omer, saying implies a one-way direction of travel of speech. Like I say something and you listen. Mudaber implies a more of a conversational thing. That's the kind of doubling that they're talking about. And so every time, what her brilliant suggestion is that every time in the Torah it says yitma, they're really understanding it as yitame. It makes other things impure as well. And that's how you get sort of these four levels after the av hatumah. And that's exactly what he's going to do. Eino omer tame. It didn't say tame. It didn't say that it was just impure. It said yitma. That means it's letame acharim. It can make other things impure. Limeid al kikar sheni shemetame et hashlishi. And this teaches you the principle of when a kikar, a loaf of bread, which is a sheni latuma, in other words, the sheni latuma, right? Any of the food inside this vessel that was touched by a sheretz became a sheni latuma, became a second level impurity. So say it's a loaf of bread in the clay vessel. Now when that loaf of bread touches a truma, something else, some other truma, some truma food, that truma food becomes shlishi latuma, it becomes third level impurity. And he hooks that teaching on this verse. And as you'll see, he didn't really derive it from the verse. What he has done is taken a tradition, which is known, this is how the law is. The law follows that path of the four levels of tuma and the av hatuma on top. That's just how it is. That's how everyone knows it in the Mishnah. There's no disagreement about that. But what he's done is he's hooked this principle on a verse. And made it part of the Torah's canon. And so when you're reading this verse, you're going to think about Rabbi Akiva's drash and associate second degree loaf of bread touching truma, making it third degree, which there's no direct evidence in the Torah for. Amar Rabbi Yeshua, and his teacher says, Rabbi Yeshua, Mi galeh afar meinecha Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai? Who will remove the dust from your eyes, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai? So Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is Rabbi Yeshua's teacher, and he is presumably long dead. This is to say, who will remove the dust from your eyes, i.e., who will like take you out of the grave to see how amazing Rabbi Akiva is? Like, in other words, he's saying, would that my teacher, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, was alive to see this amazing drasha of Rabbi Akiva. Shahayita Omer, because you used to say, you, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, my teacher, used to say, Atid dor acher letaher kikar shlishi she'in lo mikra min haTorah shehu tameh, that there'll be a generation in the future that will make pure a third degree loaf of bread, like a truma loaf of bread. They won't think that the sheni, that the second level loaf of bread can make other truma impure. She'in lo mikra min haTorah shehu tameh, because there's no verse in the Torah which makes it impure. So he's worried that this law, which is known about the second degree making third degree food, truma food, impure, he's worried that this law is going to be forgotten in the future because there's nothing in the Torah to explicitly remind people of it. V'halo Akiva talmidcha mevilo mikra min haTorah shehu tameh, she'amar kol asher b'tocho yitma. And look, Rabbi Akiva, your student, brought this verse from the Torah that it is impure, as it says, kol asher b'tocho yitma, the verse that Rabbi Akiva used. So Rabbi Yeshua is just amazed that Rabbi Akiva has managed to hook a extra strict scriptural tradition, traditional knowledge about the laws of Tumah, on a verse. And that's what he's praising Rabbi Akiva for, that to help laws not be forgotten, it's helpful to hook them onto verses, so that when you're reading the verses, because everyone's going to read the Torah, when you read the verse, you'll think about this principle and you won't forget it. This is one of the things that Rabbi Akiva is known for specifically, which is to his ability to hook Mishnaic traditions onto scriptural verses. This is one of the key places where you see that. Okay, so that was all very complicated, but basically the point is Rabbi Akiva made an amazing drasha on the same day that he made the first amazing drasha, and Rabbi Yeshua praised him for it. Okay. Now we're going to get to a totally other area of law but back to Rabbi Akiva. Bo bayom darash Rabbi Akiva. That same day, Rabbi Akiva made this drasha. Umadotem michutz la'ir et ba'at kedma alpayim ba'ama. Umikra acher omer mikir ha'ir v'chutza elef ama saviv. So this question is about, this chapter is about the cities of refuge. So it's talking about the cities of refuge that the manslayer can, manslayer, is that a word? I don't know. The person who committed manslaughter can flee to avoid the vengeance of the blood avenger. And these are the cities that, there are Levite cities that are set aside. And this is about giving the cities to the Levites, which will then be the sanctuary cities for the manslayers. And it says two things, two contradictory things. From the town pasture that you are to assign the Levites shall extend 1,000 cubits, elef ama, all the way around from the wall outwards. So that's one thing. It says from the wall, it'll be 1,000 cubits in all directions. That will be the limit of the migrash here, the town pasture, the fields. That'll be the limit of the fields. They have the town and also 1,000 cubits in every direction from the town walls. But over here it says, U'madotam michutz la'ir et bat kedma alpayim ba'ama. You shall measure off 2,000 cubits outside the town on the east side, 2,000 on the south side, etc. 2,000 on every side. This shall be pasture for their towns. So these two verses are just totally contradictory. On the one hand, there's 1,000 ama in all directions, 1,000 cubits. On the other hand, there's 2,000 cubits in every direction. So what are you going to do with this insane contradiction? So what are you going to do? So Rabbi Akiva has a solution to this contradiction between the 1,000 cubits and the 2,000 cubits. Bo vayom darash Rabbi Akiva. U'madotam michutz la'ir epat kedma alpayim ba'ama, so 2,000 cubits. U'mikra acher, and another verse, Omer, mikir ha'ir v'chutza elef ama, 1,000 cubits, saviv, all the way around. Iyaf shalomar elef ama, shekvar ne'amar alpayim ama. Iyaf shalomar alpayim ama, shekvar ne'amar elef ama. It's impossible to say he's just stating the problem. It's impossible to say that it's 1,000 cubits because it already said 2,000 cubits, but it's impossible to say 2,000 cubits because it already said 1,000 cubits. Ha, Kateside, what am I going to do with this? How do I solve this scenario? I think we talked about Kateside before, that Kateside is a question which you basically, a word you can't translate unless you know the answer. So here, ha, Kateside is something like, how do I solve this? Like, well, how do I assign the 1,000 and 2,000 cubits to different things such that this makes sense? And his solution is, because there are 2,000 cubits, if you've ever learned the laws of Shabbat, 2,000 cubits might be sparking something in your brain, which he's about to talk about. Ha Ketzad, Elef Amar Migrash, it's 1,000 cubits for the pasture, for the fields around the town. When it said 1,000, it was talking about the fields. But when it said Alpayim Amar Tchum Shabbat, when it said 2,000 cubits, what it was talking about was the Tchum Shabbat, the boundary, the Shabbat boundary, beyond which you're not allowed to walk on Shabbat. You can go up to 2,000 cubits outside of your town. Now, the verses are obviously not about the Shabbat boundary. There's no indication of a Shabbat boundary per se in the Torah, except for the fact that the Torah tells you have to stay in your place. So unless you put a pot of food before Shabbat, so you can change your tchum, you can change your boundary, but you can't ever make it more than 2,000. I need to go to a town that's 4,000. I need to go to a town that's 3,000 cubits away. I can go walk out 1,000 cubits away from the town, put a meal there before Shabbat, and then that changes my tchum. So my Shabbat boundary is no longer from the town I started with. It's now from where I left the food, which gives me 2,000 amot in every direction from where I left the food, which now will allow me to walk from my town to there, because that's within the 2,000 amot, and then from there, the 2,000 amot to the neighboring town. So I can get like an extra 1,000, really, but not much more than that. And you lose out on the other side, so I can't then go, it's a complicated area of law, but yes, you never get more than 2,000 amot, is what I'm trying to say. Point being, the verses are not themselves about this thing. They're obviously about the migrash, about the pastures around the Levite cities. And the 2,000 cubits has not come from the Torah anywhere particularly. What Rabbi Akiva has done is the same thing he did in the previous Mishnah, is he's taken a law which is known to everyone. Everyone agrees that the Shabbat boundary is 2,000 amot. And he has hooked it on a scriptural verse. He's made this unusual contradiction between 1,000 and 2,000 cubits. He's turned the one of them into really about Shabbat boundary, and that will be your scriptural hook for the Shabbat boundary. I think that you'll, some people would, well, let me read the next thing and then we'll talk about that. So he's willing to basically undermine the plain sense of the verses in order to find scriptural hooks for rabbinic principles. For legal principles. So he doesn't care that like the verse wouldn't switch topic halfway through without telling you anything about it. That doesn't matter to him. What matters to him is that he's managed to uphold both things. There's 1,000 amah around the Levite cities and 2,000 amah for every city, for every town, for your Shabbat boundary. By the way, also your Shabbat boundary only starts when you can no longer see any, when you're outside the boundaries of the town, which is normally such that you can't see any settlements. So there's basically no way to be outside your tchum between, like, I don't know, Boston and DC. There's like basically no way. You could walk all the way and never not see residential evidence. And so like you'll never be outside the tchum. So I wouldn't worry about it if you live on the East Coast. Anyway, Rabbi Eliezer Benosha Rabbi Yossi HaGlili. So they never use string from Erev. So an Erev is different. There are three types of Erev. This is an Erev Tchum, which changes your Shabbat boundary. That's the one I was speaking about. There's an Erev Chatzer. There's a courtyard Erev, which is the one that allows you to carry in a certain area. And that's the Erev that they use string for today. And they could have used string for then, though they mostly use beams around the alleyway. And then there's a third type of Erev, which is Erev Tavshilin, which allows you to prepare for Shabbat following Yom Tov. Which happens for Pesach. So those are the three types of Erev. Erev, by the way, at core is a shared meal. It's not the string. Every Erev has a meal associated with it. When you have one of those big string Erevs around Manhattan or whatever, somewhere in Manhattan, I don't remember where, somewhere there is a box of matzah or something like that, which is technically the shared property of all Jews who live in the Eruv. So you could, in theory, go to that shul where the box of matzah is kept and say, hey, I want my matzah. It's my meal. It's a shared meal. You could, in theory, do that. Yes, we're going to have to do it. Right, we'll have to do an Erev Tav Shulian this week. That's right. Yeah, if you want to prepare your meals for Shabbat after Shavuot, you will need to do that. Okay. Anyway, so Rabbi Eliezer ben Osher, Rabbi Yossi Haglili Omer, dissenting opinion. Elef Amah Migrash V'Alpaim Amah Sadot Uchramim. He actually has a different way of harmonizing the two verses. He thinks that it's 1,000 Amah for Migrash, for those kind of fields, and then 2,000 Amah for other fields and vineyards, for sort of less. So the Migrash, he thinks it's more sort of built up fields. And then like the Sadot and Chramim, the vineyards and fields, sort of more rural areas. So there's a machloket in the commentaries about whether this means that it's 1,000 Amah for Migrash and then an additional 1,000 for Sadot and Chramim and 2,000 in total, or whether it's 1,000 for Migrash and then an additional 2,000 for Sadot and Chramim, in which case it would be 3,000 in total, but nonetheless. So basically Rabbi Eliezer ben Osher, Rabbi Yossi Haglili, he basically is unwilling to make the uproot the plain sense of the verses. He thinks they must be both verses must be talking about the Levite cities, and therefore they must be referring to different things, different boundaries around the Levite cities. And that's the machloket here. So you'll also see in the commentaries that because Rabbi Akiva hooked the Tchum Shabbat on the biblical verse and Rabbi Eliezer did not, that the machloket, that their argument is about whether the Shabbat boundary is of Torah authority or rabbinic authority. There's no evidence for that in the Mishnah per se. The Mishnah doesn't have a clear distinction between things that are Doraita or things that are Darabanan, things that are of rabbinic authority or Torah authority. There's no strict difference between those two things in the Mishnah. It seems like what Rabbi Akiva is doing, like sometimes the difference comes up, but it's not a standard thing that you expect in multiple places. That seems to pick up in the Talmuds. Even the Amoraim, the later rabbis commenting on the Mishnah, already have a sharp distinction between something that's Doraita and something that's Darabanan. By the way, the key difference that you might, the key thing that why it matters, because it doesn't matter, it's still forbidden, whether it's forbidden by the rabbis or forbidden by the Torah, it's still forbidden. The key places in which that matters in modern halakha is things like if you have a lot of financial loss involved, or if there's a financial loss by following the mitzvah, if it's Torah law, maybe you have to do it anyway, and if it's rabbinic law, maybe you don't have to do it. So there's things like that. There's like cases where the rabbinic law would be more lenient if it was only rabbinic prohibition rather than a Torah prohibition, or a Torah mitzvah versus a rabbinic mitzvah. But the Mishnah doesn't have that distinct thing. Rabbi Akiva is just hooking something on the verses. He's not necessarily saying that therefore it has Torah authority or not. I think if you asked Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Eliezer ben Osher, Rabbi Yossi Haglili, if you ask them, does the Torah forbid you from walking more than 2,000 amot from your house? They would say, yes, obviously it does. But they wouldn't have the key distinction between like something made up later by rabbis or something in the Torah. That's not a key distinction for them. I think we can just squeeze in this last Mishnah over here, the last one from Rabbi Akiva. Bo bayom darash Rabbi Akiva, again on the same day. Az yashir Moshe uvnei Yisrael et hashir hazot Adonai bayomru leimor. This is the Song of the Sea, the opening of the Song of the Sea. Then Moshe and the Bnei Israel sang this song to God, and they said, saying. Now this leimor is a bit superfluous, this saying. Normally it's like leimor comes up if you want to transfer the message onto somebody else. So you'd be like, you know, Vaydaber Adonai Moshe leimor, speak to the people of Israel. But leimor here is just like random, just open speech quotes after they said this song. So Rabbi Akiva is going to make a point out of this seemingly extraneous leimor. She'ein Talmud Lamar leimor. There was no reason to say leimor. This Talmud Lamar is a classic term in Midrash Halacha, in reading verses very carefully, very hard to translate. She'ein Talmud Lamar means it didn't need to say that. There was no reason for the Torah to say that. Uma Talmud Lomar Leimor. So what does it mean to say when it says Leimor? What's the Torah trying to teach us? Balameid Shehayu Yisrael Onin Acharav Shel Moshe Al Kol Davar V'Davar Kekorin Et HaHalel V'Chach Ne'emar Leimor. It teaches that Israel answered after Moshe, after every sentence, just like they recite Hallel, and that's why it says Lemor. So in other words, the Lemor indicates some kind of call and response. By Yomru, Lemor. They said, saying. And the way that they read Hallel, by the way, is the reader would start the psalm, you would say a verse in the psalm, and then the congregation would answer, Hallelujah. And then he would do the next line, the leader would do the next line, and then the congregation would answer, Hallelujah. So similarly, the same thing here. They would repeat the first line. After every line that Moshe said, the people would answer with the first line of the Song of the Sea. That's what it means. What he says, they did it like Hallel. Rabbi Nechemia Omer, Kakorin et Shema, Velo Kakorin et Hallel. Rabbi Nechemia disagrees about the particular way they did the call and response, but he agrees that there is call and response. Rabbi Nechemia thinks they did it like the Shema instead of the way that they do Hallel. The Shema, there's a bunch of different understandings of how they did Shema, and it doesn't seem to be constant in all periods. But it's basically something like Moshe would do the first half of the verse, and then they would do the last half of the verse. And that would continue throughout. So it would be first half, last half, first half, last half. Possibly as well, they just repeated the verse, or they said the next verse. There's a bunch of different ways to understand that. But let's say it's that kind of call and response, first part of the verse, last part of the verse. Great, that's all the Bo Bayoms. And then we're going to, the last Bo Bayom we'll do tomorrow. You'll do it with Dina. The last Midrash here, and then move on to chapter 6. Okay, it's been really lovely to learn Mishnah with you every day. And Chag Sameach, everyone. I'm going to see you.